Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Rovner and I are, and the entire court, are very pleased to have Justice Sandra Day O'Connor join us today, and we're ready to proceed. First case is United States versus Hills, Tellman, and Winters.
Good morning. May it please the court. As the court knows, I'm Rick Godfrey. I'm the court-appointed counsel on appeal for Ms. Deborah Hills. Ms. Hills was convicted of two counts, conspiracy to impede the Internal Revenue Service and making a statement on her 2000 joint return, which she filed with her husband, Stephen Hills, which the allegation is she knowingly did falsely. I'm going to focus on two issues, if I might. One is the insufficiency of the evidence. And the second issue is the Fifth Amendment. As to the insufficiency of the evidence on the conspiracy count, there's no direct evidence that she participated to the fraud. In fact, the evidence in the record, for example, there's evidence from the Ohio Supreme Court in the record giving CLE credit for the very things that Mr. Tillman and others were accused of selling. The trust system's illegality was not known at the time. To say the least, it's a weak case. And the real weakness is shown by count two on the income tax return. I used to take a lot of tax in law school and I've been on the tax court a number of times. This is a joint return prepared by an accountant. The allegation is that the income from Worldwide of $18,500 was put on the wrong Schedule C. It makes no difference to the bottom line of the return. Her husband was not indicted. Her husband was not given immunity, but he did testify against Ms. Hills, although he gave no direct testimony of her willful intent or knowledge. And why did he testify? She was having an affair with Mr. Tillman. It was the ultimate husband's revenge. You read the record in this case, and I think it was very clear what happened here. Deborah Hills took the Fifth. She wouldn't cooperate with the government, and they threw the book at her. And that takes me to the other error that I want to talk about, the Fifth Amendment. The government's ratio descendi throughout the course of the trial proceedings was to ask witness after witness questions like, and if you take the Fifth, you know you're doing something wrong. Some of those questions were objected to, and the objections were sustained. Others, unfortunately, were not objected to. But Judge Mim is a very wise trial judge, and he warned the government at transcript, and it's page 2705 of the transcript, and he warned the government, it's A96 of the appendix, the following, right before closing argument. One final comment or caution. Defendant Hills did not testify, so please be very careful. There should be no mention, either directly or indirectly, about the fact that she did not testify or present evidence. And as I understand it, the only thing we have before closing statements is the stipulation, correct? He warned them. Did the government listen to his warning? No. The government put on trial a defendant who had the temerity to assert the Fifth Amendment, not just in the opening part of the closing, but in the rebuttal.
Forgive me, Mr. Godfrey, but certainly in the closing, wouldn't you agree that the government was referring to comments that were made by another defendant explaining how to keep information secret from the IRS?
No, I don't think that's a fair read of the record, and I'll tell you why. Transcript page 27, 18, and 19. Quote from the closing, opening part. You don't really need to worry about that Fifth Amendment protection unless you're worried that you're doing something illegal. They knew perfectly well what they were doing.
So it's a spillover that you are arguing.
It's more than that, because in the rebuttal closing, here's what happens. They're talking about the evidence against Ms. Hills. So if you go to page 28 to 27 of the transcript, they're talking about the evidence against Ms. Hills. So, for example, lines 1 through line 11 is about Ms. Hills. And then on line 12, the government's lawyer says, quote, all right, there are a number of things that are inconsistent with good faith in this case, hiding things from the IRS, hiding records, lying to the IRS, paying a little tax to make it look like it's legitimate, creating entities that really do nothing except to funnel money through, taking the Fifth Amendment. In this case, they're using the Fifth Amendment not as a shield to protect themselves from incrimination, but as a sword to prevent the IRS from getting the information that they are entitled to. That is in direct reference to Ms. Hills.
Who was the attorney talking about when he said they?
He's pointing to all three defendants, but this follows the count two discussion of Ms. Hills. And there's only one person who took the Fifth Amendment, Ms. Hills. But I have a more fundamental problem. You cannot draw, constitutionally, as I understand the cases, an inference of guilt from the assertion of the Fifth Amendment. And throughout the entirety of this trial, the government kept asking question after question to defendant after defendant who appeared about taking the Fifth Amendment. Go to page 2141, for example, the government's examination. Question on line 18. If what you were doing was as legal as Mr. Vallone says, then you wouldn't be incriminating yourself, would you? Mr. Knoll, objection, Your Honor. That's calling for a legal conclusion.
Sustained. Mr. Godfrey.
Yes, ma'am.
Let's talk about the way the Fifth came up. It came up in an odd manner, it seems to me, in this case, because it was one of the co-defendants who mentioned taking the Fifth while being recorded by an undercover agent, not while testifying. I'm not certain that playing the recording to the jury would have violated any, you know, Fifth Amendment rights, because they were trying, you know, the government's trying to show the MO, the modus operandi. Now, of course, they did go further and stated in closing arguments, you know, we just have a dry record. When you say they pointed to the three of them, is that what occurred in the courtroom?
Well, the record shows the reference to they after Ms. Hills, and there's only one person who actually took the Fifth. But let me go back to the predicate of Your Honor's question. Setting aside whether or not another counsel would have objected to that part of the tape, we'll set that aside. One thing is clear. The government took that tape and used that as a license to insert with witness after witness the questions, some of which were objected to or the objections were sustained, others of which unfortunately were not objected to insert the notion and the idea before the jury that the right against self-incrimination is not a right, it's an inference of guilt. And they wrapped it up in a tiny bowpin package in the closing argument, and only one person took the Fifth, and that was Ms. Hills, my client. I think my time is up for now, and I'll reserve for later. I appreciate very much the court's questions and time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Attorney Chris Donovan. I have the honor of representing Ken Tillman on this appeal. And I'll be discussing what I view as the really, to me, what could be the dispositive issue in this case, and that is that Mr. Tillman, along with other defendants, were denied their right to a speedy trial, specifically denied their right to a speedy trial under the Speedy Trial Act that mandates it to begin within 70 days. I believe that Mr. Tillman recognized his right very early on in the case. And he not only recognized his right, but he vigorously and consistently tried to exercise his right throughout this case. Despite that, both the court and Mr. Tillman's own counsel denied him that right consistently throughout this case.
Well, you have to take the position that the lawyer for Mr. Tillman cannot waive it.
That's absolutely correct.
Well, I'm not sure that's absolutely correct, though, as a matter of law.
I believe that he could not waive it because it is a fundamental right. I believe there's clear Supreme Court case law that talks about it's as fundamental as any other Sixth Amendment right. It's one of the most basic rights preserved in our Constitution.
But there are other constitutional rights that can be waived by counsel.
That's correct. I believe, though, this is one of the basic rights that can't be waived because it's comprehensible to a layperson.
But it's so integral to whether the trial counsel thinks everybody's ready to go, whether he thinks he's ready. I don't see why that's one of those rights that counsel can't waive.
I would grant that in certain cases it could be counsel's decision, for example, when a defendant doesn't know of his right or when a defendant acquiesces to his counsel and trusts his best judgment. But under the specific facts of this case, it is clear that Mr. Tillman made known to both his counsel and directly to the court by writing the letter that he sent early in the case that he knew of his right and he wanted to exercise his right and that he disagreed with his counsel's overriding his right.
Look, if we were to rule that a defendant could object to his attorney's motion for continuance, wouldn't this lead to a gaming of the system? A wily attorney could advise his client, look, I'll file for a continuance, and you should object. And if we lose and I have to go to trial, I'm prepared, then you'll have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. If we win and we delay the trial, then you'll have a speedy trial claim.
I don't believe it would gain the system, and this is where I cited in my brief to clear case law that says when a defendant is fully informed of his reasonable options and he agrees to a specific strategy and he pursues that strategy, he can't then come back later and claim that as a basis of ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think that an easy remedy for this is for the court perhaps to engage in a short colloquy with the defendant when a situation like this arises to say, you know, look, your attorney is asking for more time. He's saying that you're not prepared. He's saying that you are not ready for trial, and you're insisting on your right to a speedy trial. And I think at that point, if a defendant insists on that, and it's a knowing and intelligent decision, just like pleading guilty or just like waiving a jury trial, then I think that can't be then used later to game the system and to come back on an ineffective assistance claim.
So we just disregard the attorney's view of whether he's prepared or not?
I believe, under the specific facts of this case, yes. I mean, I believe that Mr. Tillman recognized early on that this was perhaps his best defense, maybe even his only defense, to force the government to trial as soon as possible. The government in this case waited nearly the full 6 years before the statute of limitations ran. The search was in March of 2000. The indictment comes out in May of 2006. And I believe that Mr. Tillman, he recognized with the, evidence that he knew that the government got from the search and that he knew was out there that this might be it. I want to force them to trial within 70 days.
If he objected to his lawyer's request for a continuance, why didn't he ask to change lawyers?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I believe that is eventually why he went pro se, because I think he viewed Attorney Taylor as being so opposed to his interests and so opposed to how he wanted to present his defense that he eventually did fire him. Now, he didn't do it prior to the July 14th hearing, but he did eventually do that. And he did make it clear, again, directly to the court. There's a letter in the record saying, for the record, I am not waiving my right to a speedy trial, and I do not agree with my attorney's request for this, and I want the court to know I disagree with it. And so at that point, I think he at least did do as much as he could to...
That almost tantamount to representing yourself and having counsel at the same time?
I think that Mr. Tillman accepted counsel, thinking that he would act in his best interest, and it became clear to Mr. Tillman at some point through the case that...
But you can't have it both ways. You either got to then fire him and...
Well, again, I view this as if an attorney would try to plead a client against his wishes, try to make him plead guilty. And that's clearly not something that an attorney could do unilaterally. And I feel that the right to a speedy trial is as basic as that, again, laid out in the Constitution, and that this was an improper waiver.
So the solution was not to fire his attorney and find one who was willing to proceed without continuances.
Well, I think that Mr. Tillman, if he would have done that, would have also been in a catch-22, because one of the bases under the Speedy Trial Act is continuity of counsel. So if he wants a speedy trial and he fires his attorney, he knows that that's going to toll the time under the Speedy Trial Act. And so, again, I think he did what he thought was the only option he had, which was to write the letter, inform the court that he does not want to waive his right to a speedy trial. And I think also that Mr. Tillman did want an attorney to help assist him at trial at that stage, but he didn't want to do that at the expense of waiving his right to a speedy trial.
What's your best case of support for your position? Because I would have thought the attorney had the right to make that decision of when the trial was ready.
I believe the best case is Klopfer versus North Carolina. That stands for the proposition that this is as fundamental a right as any other right in the Constitution or in the Sixth Amendment. As far as that the attorney can't waive a client's fundamental right, I would refer to Brookhart v. Jandis, I believe it was. That's where
from
the
what court?
That was the United States Supreme Court case also. That was the case where the attorney tried to basically just proceed with what's called a prima facie case and not have the government prove its burden. The Supreme Court in that case found that that's a per se violation of a fundamental right, reversed that without having to show prejudice, without having to make a further showing. So those are probably the two key cases I would rely upon, that it's a fundamental right, and it's a fundamental right that the attorney cannot waive over the client's objections. If I may, I would also like to touch upon the continuance that was granted for the motion for bill of particulars by co-defendant Winters. I do think that this court should adopt the approach that the Sixth Circuit has outlined in Tinklenburg. I believe that this court's precedent in Montoya is contrary to the plain language of the Speedy Trial Act when it says that only delay resulting from the filing of a pretrial motion is excludable time.
But the Sixth Circuit is truly an outlier on that issue.
It is currently. I believe, though, that the recent Supreme Court case in Bloat, while not directly on point with this issue, does support the Sixth Circuit approach. Bloat warns against the Act's automatic exclusions swallowing the 70-day rule, and Bloat also reaffirms that no word, sentence, or clause in a statute should be read to make it superfluous, void, or insignificant. And I think what all the other circuits do, including this court in Montoya, is they read the word delay out of the statute, and they don't require that a showing of delay exists before that time is excluded. And I do believe that's incorrect. And I see that I think I'm into my rebuttal time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Heller.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. You've all seen the commercial if you've watched TV. The man in a lab coat with a stethoscope hanging out of his pocket, and he's got a sign that says, "I owe the IRS $3 million." And the card flips down. He says, "But I only paid him $1 million." Or the grandmother comes out and she says, "I owed the government $200,000, but I only paid $100,000.
What channel is that?
Well, that's on all the channels. J.K. Harris, Tax Masters, those commercials. And in this case, Mr. Winters, in the year in question, didn't owe the government anything. There wasn't any tax owed on this return. The important point about that is he didn't even have to file this return. Now, the government, in pages 13 and 14 of their brief, accurately set out what's required for a conviction under 72061. None of those include the filing of the tax return. In their brief, they jump from the requirements for conviction to the conclusion that the statute of limitations starts when the return is filed. And granted, that language is used in some of the cases that they cite. For example, it's a footnote in the Miller case. Clearly, the statute would have started to run by the time the return is filed, but it can run earlier, and not one of the cases cited by the government is this situation. This is a return that didn't have to be filed. Filing has nothing to do with this. It was complete when the perjury was committed, and that was on April 3rd in the year 2000. Mr. Winters clearly was not indicted until April 6, 2006, 6 years and 3 days later. Now, the cases, even the ones cited by the government, indicate that the statute of repose is to be liberally construed in favor of the citizen. There can't be any question in this case. The cases cited by the government talk about things like what happens to the statute of limitations when you file your return early. Or, in one case, the argument was the statute started when the return was due as opposed to when it was filed on extension. But none of the cases cited by the government, none of them, suggest that there is some rule that says that the statute of limitations starts when something that is not required for the commission of the crime occurs. If you accept what this court has said, what the Supreme Court has said, what the government says in their prosecution manual, and what they say in their brief, that the four elements of the crime, when completed, start the commission of the offense, then this crime was committed if there was a crime. on April 3rd of 2000. Now, we have suggested in our original brief that there were other issues, the admission of, for example, an unsigned tax return. And the government's response to that argument, it demonstrates the whole point. They're saying, well, it shows that he's inconsistent, that they argued in their brief, it makes higher income for the bank, lower for the government. But that's the whole point. Using that argument says to the jury, here's an unsigned document, and we're showing that he's lying. And that return, an unsigned return, isn't admissible for that purpose or any other purpose for that matter. But we don't need to get there if in fact this crime was committed on April 3rd, as I suggest it is, then the statute ran before the indictment. There just isn't any question about that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Davis?
May it please the court, counsel. Joining me at counsel table is Assistant United States Attorney Hillary Fruman. I will address the issues in the same order in which defendants raise them, unless the court would request that I do something different.
All right, Ed.
First, starting with Deborah Hills, the closing argument, the court reviews for plain error. In her brief, Ms. Hills states that because of the cautionary statement by the district court, they don't have to establish plain error. But because if you view the argument in context, it's very plain that the prosecutors were referring to the statements that Mr. Tillman made to Agent Price during the undercover conversation.
Don't you basically have to stand on your head to get to that result? I for one find it troubling that the government equated the Fifth Amendment with guilt, particularly after such a strong admonition from the district court not to mention Ms. Hill's a failure to testify directly or indirectly. I mean, why isn't this a clear statement from the government that only the guilty evoke the Fifth Amendment? What are you doing, talking about the Fifth Amendment?
Well, here, because Mr. Tillman stated in the undercover conversation that if someone comes to look for records, they're going to disappear, we're going to shred them, or I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment. We had to negate his claim of good faith.
You can't tie it into Ms. Hills, can you?
We weren't tying it into Ms. Hills, Justice O'Connor. We believe that if you read it in context, it's plain that the only thing that the prosecutor was talking about was Mr. Tillman's statement that basically showing that he knew what he was doing was wrong and that he didn't have good faith, which was the defense to a tax claim.
Well,
tax count.
You heard the argument today
by
counsel for Ms. Hills, and he explained how the government did mention the Fifth Amendment in connection with her situation.
If you're looking at the places
in the record, I mean, we can all go look at it, but how do you respond to that?
Well, one of those was a cross-examination of Mr. Tillman. The page 2141 of the record that he cited to was a cross-examination of Mr. Tillman. And that was talking about the statement that Tillman made. That there's no way you can tie that to Ms. Hills. And he said that there were numerous references during other cross-examination of other witnesses. He said defendants, but other witnesses. We believe that there were maybe two or three that were not objected to and sustained. And in a record that was 2,700 pages, a 17-day trial, that's not something that's going to stick in someone's mind, especially when it was so clear in closing argument that they were only talking about Mr. Tillman's claim, his statement to Agent Price, that Price had nothing to worry about in terms of the privacy of his records because they would take care of it by shredding them.
She was the only one, was she not, who relied on the Fifth Amendment?
She did not testify at trial. That's correct. But I believe that no reasonable juror listening to that closing argument would have mistaken that as a comment on her election not to testify.
Well, who is they? As my mother used to say, who is they?
uh, I think it's just a sort of a general comment. I think it was just a general statement in terms of someone who was present and was making those kinds of statements wouldn't believe that what they were doing was correct. And see, I use they myself.
Uh-huh.
I think it's sort of it's a way of not naming the person when you're in a rush and trying to think on your feet.
I know, but you know, you're equating they with a real, but you know, Fifth Amendment are those are buzz. That's a buzz phrase. Those are buzzwords. Fifth Amendment.
But I think, remember, they had right before the statement in opening closing, they had played the transcript of Mr. Tillman's statement to Agent Price. You read that in context, there's no way a juror is going to be confused and think that the government is improperly commenting on the defendant's, on Ms. Hill's decision not to testify.
You're right. Talking about...
I'm sorry. The juror's not going to think that they're improperly doing so.
I don't believe if you read it in context, they're going to think that is the logical conclusion, that by commenting on what Mr. Tillman said to Agent Price, that that's somehow also referring inclusively to Ms. Hills?
Well, they has me bothered.
As I said, I think, Your Honor, if you read it in context, if you're sitting as a juror in context.
I've read it, but not as a juror.
But I think a juror sitting listening in context would view this as a statement only relating to Mr. Tillman.
Okay, but it was the government who decided to try all three of them at once, and she was the only one who was going to not testify, so presumably the government had to kind of watch its step.
And the government did. The government was very careful in its statements. There was never any direct reference to her, direct or, I would say, indirect reference to her decision not to testify at trial.
Well, that's the question, whether this was. That's the exact question.
It is, and all I can say, Your Honor, is you refer to the context of the statement. If you look at the statement in context, it's all about the kinds of actions that refute a claim of good faith on the part of Mr. Tillman.
But that's casting, exercising your right of Fifth Amendment in a negative light, that by doing that, then he's showing that this scheme was illegal.
Well, it's clear from the case law that it's not improper to refer to a Fifth Amendment right in all instances. And we believe here where...
Well, here you cast it negatively in that, I mean... In his comments.
Well, basically his comment was, it was just further evidence that he was going to do anything he could to make sure that no records were released to the IRS.
His comment was, I'm not going to say anything.
Well, which is the same thing as, essentially it's the same thing as shedding, I'll shred all the records, I'll make them disappear. It's more of the same. It's basically saying, I will do everything I can to hide the records from the IRS, even though the IRS is entitled to the records.
May I please just ask you this?
Of course.
Did Mr. Tillman's admission of fraud at the get-go hamper Ms. Hill's
I don't believe
defense?
So. The judge made it very clear that the only relevant time period in terms of when he was to consider whether or not he believed in good faith that what he was doing was correct was the time it was happening. His statement at the beginning of the trial was well after the end of the offense conduct.
Huh.
Did I misunderstand your question?
Well, I mean, when a lawyer, you know, gets up and says, my client is, you know, did do this, and that person is being tried with two others, it sure didn't help Ms. Hill.
Well, but Tillman also said that I believed at the time that what I was doing was correct. So by saying that he believed at the time what he was doing was correct, he's certainly not hurting Mr. Winters or Ms. Hill's. Because that's not saying anything about whether or not they believed at the time. And in fact, I mean, I suppose if given that Ms. Hills was saying, well, I was doing what Mr. Tillman told me to do, then that would be to her benefit for him to say, I believed at the time that what I was doing was legally correct.
I want to take you somewhere else.
Go ahead. I'm at your... You're steering. I'm just...
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. What happens... when a court states a legitimate reason for delay granting and grants a continuance, such as allowing time to prepare a Wait a minute, I'm steering.
Water, sorry.
Taking allowing time, enough time for preparation of a complex case, but also mentions an impermissible reason, such as prioritizing the cases where defendants are in custody. How do we know what reason was primary with that judge?
Well, I think in this instance, the judge made plain that he was granting the continuance based on Mr. Taylor's motion, and that Mr. Taylor's motion was based on the need for additional time to prepare for trial. You look at all of the all of the statements by the district court during that hearing. The court was making clear that the main reason is Mr. Taylor said he'd only read, I think, around 500 pages of the discovery. That was far from, he wasn't ready. Mr. Berenger, who was then Ms. Hill's attorney, basically said, well, I can proceed for trial, but by the way, Your Honor, I'm not really ready. I can do it if I have to, but by the way, Your Honor, I'm not really ready. So you read all of the statements by the district court, it's very plain that the reason, the primary predominant reason for the continuance was because Mr. Taylor wasn't ready to present Mr. Tillman's defense.
Now, but what do we make of Mr. Taylor's, rather unusual statements that he asked for a continuance to curry favor with the district court and the U.S. Attorney's Office? You know, he said what goes around comes around.
I believe those statements were in the second hearing before Judge Mim. Judge Mim then went back and looked at the statements in the original hearing and focused on those. And I think you have to focus on the reasons at the time. I mean, for one thing, you can't retroactively exclude time. So you've got to look at the statements at the time that the exclusion was made. And here, Judge McCuskey made it very clear that the reason was based on the motion filed by Mr. Taylor, who wasn't ready for trial. And none of the other defendants were ready for trial either. As was noted by the prosecution and by the defendant, there was lots of discovery to be reviewed. They weren't ready for trial at the time, Your Honor. I think if you look at the context, and that's what you're going to have to do, you have to review the context. And the context makes it very plain that the predominant reason for the continuance was Mr. Taylor's inability to proceed to trial. I mean, he basically said that it would be in the interests of my client and the public to continue. Do I get to take the rudder back?
What?
Can I take the rudder back?
The what?
The rudder to steer.
Oh, the rudder. Yes.
Thank you.
Technical phrases.
Sorry. Going to the sufficiency. Excuse me. I forgot. The sufficiency of the evidence in a conspiracy case, circumstantial evidence is fine. You're going to very rare will you have direct evidence of someone's mental state, and I think if you look at the evidence on the conspiracy count, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. There's more than sufficient evidence to support the conviction. There was evidence that Ms. Hills was involved in the sale of trusts, that she received payment from the sale of the trusts, that she was knowledgeable about trusts, that she had signed an agreement to become a contractor for Aegis. She promoted the trusts. She notarized documents before they were signed. I mean, you don't notarize documents in advance. That's certainly a telltale sign that something's wrong if you're notarizing documents that no one has signed. She worked closely with Mr. Tillman. There's simply so much evidence that that's more than sufficient to sustain the convictions. Also, you have evidence that in her office there were documents, IRS documents, basically indicating that the types of trusts that were being sold were abusive trusts, and these are the very characteristics of the trusts that were here as well. In terms of the failure to file a Schedule C for her income from WFS and WFLA. That was a question for the jury. The jury could believe what Stephen Hills had said, that she was in charge of the family's financial matters, and that a return showing an income of $137 would definitely be something that she knew is not correct. The Speedy Trial Act.
Will you remind me? Did her accountant testify?
Mr. Madatal, I don't believe so. No, Mr. Madatal did not testify. The testimony was largely from Stephen Hills on the false return count.
The angry husband. The angry ex-husband.
They were separated at the time. I don't believe that they were then divorced. But that was for the jury to assess his credibility. That's not the job that this court takes. I don't think that you like playing fact finder on appeal. Now, in terms of the Speedy Trial Act, first the
background was brought to the attention of the jury, I assume.
I believe so. They certainly knew that at the time that they were that the two were not not a happy couple. I think it was fairly clear from reading the testimony that on cross examination, Mr. Hills was not treated lightly by defendants. The Speedy Trial Act. First, Mr. Taylor didn't waive the Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. He simply agreed to a continuance under the Speedy Trial Act, which, the defendant sort of conflates the Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial with the very regimented 70 days under the Speedy Trial Act. We don't think that's appropriate, and we don't think that's supported by the case law. As you said, basically, Judge Rovner, basically, he could game the system if we were to not have this as a function for counsel. It's very clear from the New York versus I forget the name of the case. Sorry, but the Supreme Court New York versus Hill case, granted that involved an Interstate Detainer Act, but the court there cited Taylor versus Illinois, another Supreme Court case, for the proposition that the lawyer has the full authority to manage the trial. And if deciding when you're ready to proceed to trial isn't something that's solely within the power of the counsel to decide, then we don't know what is. In terms of Mr. Winter's argument, the statute of limitations, it's you look at the U.S. versus Habig case, a Supreme Court case, which is a case under 26 U.S.C. 7202, which is very similar to 72061. Basically, the statute of limitation begins to run when the return is filed. There's a special provision under 26 U.S.C. 7205 that if you file a return on or before the due date, the statute of limitations doesn't begin until the due date. But this return was filed a year and a half late. I believe there may have been an extension, but it was at least 1 year late. So it definitely doesn't fall within the exception of under 7502. The Supreme Court in U.S. versus Lombardo, a very, very old Supreme Court case, basically indicated that the normal order of things is that something isn't filed until it's received by the party that is supposed to be receiving it. And there are also some cases that hold that making a return requires the filing of a return. If the court has no further questions, the government will rest on its brief. Thank you very much.
How much time? 2.5 minutes, Mr. Godfrey.
Thank you. Judge Rovner, if my recollection serves me correct, not only was the fact that they were estranged brought up, but the government asked whether or not Mr. Tillman and Ms. Hills were having a special relationship, that is, boyfriend and girlfriend. 4 points about the Fifth Amendment. First, who is the they? This is a conspiracy case. There are three defendants. Second, what is the context? Please look, if at no other page of the transcript, page 2827. They're talking about Ms. Hills. They're not talking about a tape. Then from lines 12 to 22,
They talk about taking the Fifth Amendment. That's in the closing rebuttal. I don't think there's any question what the government did here. Third, throughout the trial, they asked other witnesses questions, Justice O'Connor, about the Fifth Amendment, treating the Fifth Amendment as a badge of guilt, not a right of the innocent. Some of those questions were objected to. I cited that. Some were not. But that is the vice in the government's prosecution. In answer to Judge Rosner's question, we can debate whether or not there should have been an objection made about the tape. But you can carry it too far. The government cannot cite a single case from any court in any jurisdiction supporting what they did here. Not a one. And the Supreme Court of the United States says both on indirect cases and on direct cases says this shall not stand. We're better than this. Our government is better than this. Years ago, Justice, I think Brandeis said something about that just the citizens must turn square corners with the government, but so too the government with their citizenry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Godfrey. Much time. You have 1 minute, Mr. Donovan.
Thank you. The government mentioned that none of the defendants were ready for trial. The government wasn't ready for trial in this case. The government, in their brief, cited that on the July 14th hearing, pages 8 to 9 of the transcripts, that certainly boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes of more discovery is going to be disclosed in the future. The government was more than happy to sit by and let Attorney Taylor waive my client's right to a speedy trial. And the government characterizes this not as a waiver, but merely as asking for a continuance, and they cite to New York versus Hill. New York versus Hill is an interstate agreement on detainer case. It does not deal with the fundamental right, like this case does, of the Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. And so I think it's clearly distinguishable on those grounds. And just to go back for a minute and talk about the improper factors that Judge Robner mentioned, the court relied on numerous improper factors. It relied on concern over ineffective assistance of counsel should the continuance not be granted. It relied on priority of in-custody defendants versus out-of-custody defendants. It relied on congestion of its own calendar, which is clearly an expressly prohibited factor under the Act. And then it made generic statements along the lines that this was a voluminous discovery case that was paper-intensive but didn't analyze under the Speedy Trial Act's specific provisions why this would require continuance, why this made the case so complex or unusual that the interest of justice demands it. So I think in this case, it's not clear, as the government says it is, that the primary reason for this continuance was Taylor's need for more time. I think it was clear there was numerous other improper factors considered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Heller? You have 6 minutes, Mr. Heller.
Thank you. I assure the court I won't use all of them. The Habig case simply does not carry any weight in this case. That's a case where, by a special statute that absolutely everybody agrees doesn't apply here, the return was filed in advance of the due date, and that statute says it doesn't start to run until the due date. Does no applicability here whatsoever. None of the cases cited by the government stand for make the leap that the government makes on page 14 of their brief. Here are the elements, therefore the statute doesn't start until a return is filed. And in fact, if you take that position, then this court has been wrong in those cases that say you can have a conviction without filing, and the government's prosecution manual, which says you can prosecute without having the return filed, is wrong. They can't have it both ways. It is clear that the statute runs when the commission of the crime is complete. This return was delivered to the United States government, signed under oath, delivered to an agent of the United States government on April 3, 2000. 6 years later, Mr. Winters had not been indicted. The statute ran, and his conviction on that count should be reversed. Thank you, counsel.
And the court wants to thank Mr. Godfrey and Mr. Donovan for your fine representation and accepting the appointment in these cases. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement. And